Okay, I want to tell you a little about some recent stuff I've been doing. But I have been told that not everybody knows all my activities, so I will give some background material too.
You can stand back and point at the screen.
I haven't really started yet.
But we've got to see your pictures.
I'm coming to that now. So I want to tell you a little about contact mechanics and about rubber friction on smooth surfaces. And rubber friction on rough surfaces I've been working on for a long time, and that was really the beginning of all this activity. But smooth surfaces I just started half a year ago. So what is interesting with this topic of, for example, contact mechanics is that it involves a lot of length scales. And I indicated here, suppose we have a hard, rough surface, we have a rubber block or some other elastic solid, we bring them in contact, we squeeze them together with some pressure, and we look at the system at low magnification, then it might look like it looks here with some non-contact region and some contact region. But if we magnify this contact region here, this surface turns out to have roughness at a shorter length scale. And in general, we don't make perfect contact, so there will be some new non-contact region. And then we magnify one of those contact regions. At the higher magnification, we observe even smaller roughness, shorter wavelengths, and we still don't make perfect contact even at this length scale. And this, in principle, could go on the whole way down to atomic dimension. And if there would not be an atomic cutoff, one can even show mathematically that the real contact would be zero. Of course.
On these pictures where the area, real area of contact is a small fraction, but in your cartoon it's a large fraction. Is this how it works in your system?
How do you know whether it is large contact? When you come to this scale here, you have to take into account that every time the contact area gets smaller.
I think what he means is that it's bigger than the apparent area.
You mean because of the curvature here? Because this area gets bigger. When I speak about the contact area here, I'm going to tell you about the projected contact area. So it's a contact area projected on the XY plane. Of course, the true contact area is also interesting, particularly when you study adhesion, but one can easily correct for or take that into account. So when I speak about contact area here, I always mean the projected on the XY plane.
But it's also just because there's a lot of conformity between the top surface and the bottom.
That's what I'm saying. If you look at this piece here, the contact area I'm going to speak about is the one projected on the XY plane. The real contact area is bigger because the surface here is not flat.
The answer to his question is yes.
Yes. because I did not understand it from the beginning. Okay, good. Just to show you how this looks like, this is from a very small calculation. This was a molecular dynamics calculation. We squeeze an elastic block with a smooth surface against a randomly rough self-affined fractal substrate. And we look at the system at two different magnifications. At low magnification, it looks like this. This is small squares here because that's a grid size we're using in the plotting here. If you look at the higher magnification, you can see that this contact area, which look compact at this low magnification, breaks up into other contacts with small non-contact regions inside them. Now, I've been working now for 4 years or so on mainly on rubber friction, where all this activity started. And all these theories I've been working on, the only thing you need to know about the surface is the surface roughness power spectra. That's true both for contact mechanics, for adhesion, and for the rubber friction. And the power spectra is defined by this equation here. We have a rough profile, which you can measure by optical methods or by using atomic force microscope on a small length scale. In the context of tire friction on a roll surface, they use optical method because you're interested in rather big surface areas, and then you cannot use atomic force microscope. Anyway, you measure the height profile here, away from the average plane, which is a dashed line here, and you calculate the height correlation function, like I've indicated here, and you make an ensemble average, or in practice you can often do an average over the surface area. That's the same thing in many cases. And you take the Fourier transform of that, and you get the power spectra. And if you look at the real surface, and this figure down here shows the power spectra of a road surface, two different asphalt road surfaces. You can see that this is a log-log plot, and here's a wave vector, and here is a power spectra with 10 logarithm. You can see there's two different regimes. One is almost linear slope here, which corresponds to a power relation between, it means that the power spectra depends on the wave vector as a power. And then there's a roll-off region where beyond, when Q becomes small enough or the wavelengths become long enough, it flattens out. And it usually it looks like this for engineering type of surfaces. This roll-off here comes because if you take an asphalt road surface, it's built up from small sand particles with a diameter of maybe up to 1 centimeter. And this Q vector here corresponds to 2 pi over roughly 1 centimeter. So the surface looks sort of smooth when you look at it at such a low magnification that you cannot observe these largest sand particles. Now, the most basic quantum mechanics topic consider squeezing an elastic solid against a randomly rough surface. So, for example, this can be infinite hard, and this is elastic. And we're interested of what is the area of real contact as a function of this squeezing load. And this is not a trivial problem, and it has a long history. It goes back to Hertz. He approximated all these asperities with spherical bumps. And he put them on equal height. When you do that and apply the Hertz contact mechanics theory, which you approximately can apply if you assume these contacts are independent of each other, then you get that the area of real contact depends non-linearly on the squeezing force. And this is almost never observed in reality when you have a randomly rough surface. So what is wrong with this theory? The first thing to correct it is to put in a distribution of heights of these asperities. If you do that, which was done by Greenwood and Williamson, they assumed the Gaussian distribution of heights here, you get that the area of real contact is almost proportional to the squeezing force, but not quite, unless you assume an exponential distribution of heights, which is not so realistic. I have shown that, again, a sort of approximate theory, but the theory I've developed shows that the area of real contact is exactly proportional to the squeezing force for low, small squeezing forces. And low, I mean that the area of real contact must be small compared with the nominal contact area. It's clear that if you squeeze so hard that you start to reach contact everywhere, then the area cannot increase anymore. So this is asymptotic behavior as long as the area of real contact is small compared with the nominal contact area. And small means maybe up to 10% or so in practice.
And you're making an assumption about the materials, as with the previous two models, that it's homogeneous isotropic linear elasticity.
Exactly. This theory I've developed can also be applied when this is viscoelastic. It can also be applied in an approximate way when you take into account yield processes. But I'm not going to tell you about that.
It looks like a very hard problem in the theory of elasticity if the changes of the angle are very big or finite. You see what I mean?
Sharp corners.
Yeah, if it's sharp corner. This is if you wait a little, I will tell a little more about this, and maybe basically I don't. Okay, let me. I will come a little later to that question. Otherwise, we'll discuss it towards the end.
So in this case, the lower surface is rigid, and it's only the upper one.
Left. Yeah, but this in quantum mechanics, at least if you have frictionless contact, this is not a limitation because you can allow both of them to be elastic, we only need to introduce this effective elasticity, which depends on the elasticity of the two materials. Okay, so what is the idea behind this theory I've developed? It is the following. Here we have a rubber ball, for example, squeezed against a rough surface, and we look at the system at different magnification. At the lowest magnification, we don't see this roughness. The surface looks flat. We squeeze it together, and we can calculate the contact area because we have a flat surface and a spherical ball. It's easy to calculate the contact area. Just Hertz contact theory, basically. And then we increase the magnification, and we observe that there is roughness, and there is some non-contact region. So what we do now at this particular magnification, and the magnification here is L, which is the diameter of this original contact area, divided by lambda. And lambda is the shortest wavelength which I am able to resolve at this particular magnification. Then when I look at system at this particular magnification, what I do is that I smoothen out all wavelength components which are shorter than the lambda which I'm looking at. This is similar to the people using renormalization group processes. So if I do that, I obtain a surface which is smooth at this magnification. It is rough, but it has no roughness which is smaller than this wavelength lambda here. So now again I can calculate, at least it's a well-defined problem, I can calculate the area of real contact between these two objects. It gets more complicated, but in principle I can calculate it. And the function which interests me is how the area of real contact change when I change the magnification. So here P, this is, I divide the original area here, I divide the area here with the original area. And this function P, if you look at it qualitatively, it must always look like this. At lowest magnification, it looks like you have contact everywhere, so you start at 1, because these are equal to each other. And then you increase magnification, and this function will drop continuously. And the true contact between two solids you would get, in principle, by looking at such high magnification that the shortest wavelength is of order atomic dimension. So I'm not going to tell too much about the formalism. I just wanted to say I'm not going to show much mathematics in this talk because I know also there are some experimentalists here. But I want to say a few words. So this formalism is based on presenting an equation of motion for the stress distribution at the interface when you look at the system at particular magnification. And I've shown that this equation satisfies approximately a diffusion type of equation where time is replaced by magnification and spatial coordinate by the stress, and there's diffusion constant which depends on the magnification. And it's given by this equation here. This is elastic modulus of the solid. This is a nominal squeezing pressure. This Poisson ratio, and here enters the power spectra. And instead of telling how this is derived, I want to tell you qualitatively how it sort of comes about. So suppose we squeeze a block against a surface, and we look at the system at the lowest magnification, the surface looks flat here. When we apply this nominal squeezing pressure here, we will have the same squeezing pressure acting upwards here, at least if you have a frictionless contact. So at this lowest magnification, the stress distribution at the interface will just be a Dirac delta function centered at this average stress here, applied stress. Now we look at the system at high magnification. Then we observe that you have really just aspirate contact like that. And the local stress in the aspirate contact here in the center will be, in general, much higher than the applied stress. That means that this function here, it must get a tail which extends to much higher stresses here. At the same time, it must have a tail which extends the whole way down to zero, because if you look at the local stress in this contact region here, when you go towards the edge here, where you go into non-contact, the stress will vanish continuously, at least if you neglect adhesion. So you have a tail which extends the whole way down to zero stress here. And in fact, we can show analytically that there's a boundary condition, namely that the stress in this point here must vanish. The stress distribution must vanish in that point, which is not satisfied in many finite element calculations which have been performed up to now, and I will just comment on it in one moment, because it has to do with the fact that they are not good enough, it has not been performed accurately enough. No, it's very easy to understand. The IRL contact, according to this theory, is proportional to the squeezing force. I'm only looking at the case now of a small applied squeezing force. It's proportional to the squeezing force. Here is elastic modulus. Here's the power spectra to the minus integral over the power spectra to the minus 1/2. And then there's the prefactor kappa. And before I developed my theory, there was another theory. The most accurate earlier theory is due to Busch. He found this value for this factor kappa here. I find another value, namely this quantity here. And then there have been some finite element calculations to decide who is best of these two theories. But let me say to begin with, this theory you can only apply when you squeeze with such a small force that the area of real contact is very small and you are in this linear regime. My theory is valid for all squeezing forces. You can also apply it to viscoelastic solids, which you cannot do for that. You can also include adhesion, in fact, which you cannot do in these earlier theories. So this is a much more flexible theory. But in addition to that, I want to show you this figure here from a finite element calculation, which shows the factor kappa as function of Hurst exponent. They assume the self-affine fractal surface with a Hurst exponent, which is related to the fractal dimension by this equation here. And here's the Boucher limit, and here's my calculation. And here are the results of the finite element calculation. A typical surface of engineering interest has a fractal dimension of 2.2 or so. That's 0.8. And if you go to 0.8 here, you see it's rather small difference between the numerical calculation and my prediction here. And I claim, in fact, that if you make a calculation to converged, this curve will move down even more, closer to my line. So what do I mean by converged? Let me tell you what the problem is when you do these finite element calculations. First, finite element calculation, you can only do on very small systems, because otherwise you run into computer time problem and also storage problem. And that's one of the reasons for why people have not really converged these calculations properly. So to explain this, the kind of pressure distribution I predict theoretically from this model is given by something which looks like I've indicated here. What usually comes out of finite element calculations is shown in the lower curve here. It doesn't satisfy the boundary condition that P should vanish at zero stress. It stops at a finite value here. And the reason for that is due to the fact that basically all calculations up today, except for one calculation done 2 years ago, which was actually not published. It only exists as something that you can find on the internet in German. And all other calculations, basically, when you do a finite element calculation, you have to introduce a mesh or nodes. And you have to keep a finite distance between the mesh points. And the problem is that in all the calculations, the distance between the mesh points at the surface here has been of order the wavelength of the shortest roughness on the surface. And in order to really describe contact mechanics properly, you need to use a mesh which has maybe 100 mesh points within one wavelength of the shortest roughness of the surface, on the surface. And this makes it very hard to study more than one decade in length scale, in roughness, if you want to solve this problem. And the consequence of that, which is easy to understand, is that instead of getting this kind of curve like I have here, you get a curve which goes up here and here. Because in order for it to go down like that, you need to be able to have enough mesh point close to the edges of this contact, which you get when you squeeze them together here, the kind of Hertzian contacts.
So the physical difference between these two curves is that your theory is making the prediction that the fraction of the surface that's not in contact, that has zero stress, is zero? Is that how I should understand
No, this is not. This is an integral. So this region here, if you think about the Hertzian contact, this region, the smallest stress is a circle at the periphery of the Hertzian contact. So it's a small strip. This contribution here corresponds to a contribution from a small strip around the boundary line. Before Mark comment, can I just tell about the consequence of this, and then you can make your comment. The consequence of this is that if we apply a constant given load, and we compare these two different situations here, if you have a given load, this integral here, which is a load, has to be the given load. And here you have an integral involving sigma and then this probability distribution here. And when you make this integral, large sigma will be most important. So in order for this integral to be the same in both cases, if you take away stuff from here, you have to put it out here, but you have to put much less area here than you took away here, because here it is weighted by a much larger sigma. So this is the difference. Now we look at the area of real contact, which is proportional to this, which is given by this integral here. And in that case, you can see that the red curve will give you a smaller area of real contact than the blue curve, because the area you took away here and put it here is much less. You took away area here, but you put in much less area here, which means that this integral, which is just the area under the curve, will be smaller when you do a proper calculation, proper converged calculation, which starts in the origin here. Okay, good. Mark, can...
Let me just make... The reason that this particular probability vanishes at zero load is because when you do contact mechanics and you have non-adhesive contact, any contact which you assume is smooth and differentiable to arbitrary mathematical orders, okay? Then it turns out the stress underneath this contact in continuum theory has a singularity. It comes in with infinite slope. If it comes in with infinite slope, then you get this probability zero because there's nothing at zero pressure. You're going infinitely fast, okay? Now, this continuum picture only works if there's you really have something with no spectral weight, with no roughness at the smaller length scales than the contact, okay? And I think that rather than saying that our calculation is right or wrong, I will say that our calculation is based on a different philosophy, which is that as far as people who've made measurements of surfaces have seen, they do not look perfectly spherical at the smallest length scale. They continue to look rough. And so to try to resolve in this artificial way, which continuum mechanics people like to do, is not necessarily the most physical situation. There's problems with using continuum mechanics with surfaces that remain rough down to the smallest length scale, but it's a fundamental problem with continuum mechanics.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things that I think comes out of both of our calculations is that what matters is the slope at the smallest length scale. And that was on his previous And therefore, the smallest length scales dominate, and those are the ones that are least well known and least well described by continuum.
Yes.
What does it look for an atomic solid? Because, I mean,
yeah, but can I can
if you extrapolate,
I am the one who gives the presentation here, so. let me tell you about my philosophy on this problem. I completely agree that continuum mechanics is not valid when you reach the atomic scale. And your computer simulation is not valid either when you reach the atomic. You're also using continuum mechanics.
Yeah.
And you describe, if you want to have your picture valid down to atomic dimension, then your nodal points would become like atoms. That's the way you interpret it. That's the only way it would. Okay, so.
Roughness
on that length scale, right? Now I say the following: the most best approach, in my opinion, to do in the, to solve this problem, is to use the continuum mechanics, because you cannot use atomic. If you have a practical system with 9 Descartes of length scale in roughness, you cannot apply atomistic viewpoint to all those 9 Descartes in length scale. You can never solve such a problem. So I claim use continuum mechanics until you reach a few nanometer in wavelength resolution. And beyond that point, I agree with everybody, you need to use an atomistic viewpoint if that interests you. So what I'm saying is the following. We can use my prescription down to a wavelength of a few nanometer in resolution. So then we reach, then we have the whole time the kind of context I'm spoken about in my talk here. Then the question is, so then we know. That means that when we reach, say, 5 nanometers resolution, we know what is our, we know how the contact area looks like. We know where the area of real contact is. Then when we go from this, when we go down to atomic resolution, what it means is that we have to take those individual contact areas and actually put in the fact that we have maybe individual atoms sitting on the surfaces here and interacting with the solids and doing molecular dynamics or whatever you want. I think in most practical application, nobody cares about this, because if you look at real systems, you don't know what you have on the level of atomic dimension anyway. Real surfaces are, you cannot go in and look with an atomic force microscope every time you want to use contact mechanics theory. I think from a practical point of view, what happened in these last few nanometer is basically useless.
Equation at kappa, don't you end up getting that the area of real contact is related to the RMS slope of the surface at the smallest length scale resolved?
Yes, I get.
So therefore, the smallest length scale that you resolve to dominates the entire solution.
Therefore,
the roughness of the smallest length scale, we both agree, is at the heart of the problem. And so it gets a little tricky when one says we're going to apply this down to some length scale and then do something else below it. I don't think anyone's really answered that question.
I think you cannot do anything else. There's no other option for you. You cannot go in with a molecular dynamics and solve a problem from microscopic length scale down to atomic length scale. It's not possible. You need to use a continuum mechanics. In fact, you cannot even use computer simulations because you cannot treat 90 cars in length scale with finite element or any other method. You need to have an analytical theory like the one I've developed here, which you might be able to test in some finite length scale regime.
Even if you find an element and you find a contact where you know there is a certain radius of contact, you could still say what the pressure distribution look like if I had run MD simulations. So, and you know, then you could say I have this radius of contact. Let's say it's 10 nanometers. Let's think about whether I have locally a commensurate, incommensurate, or amorphous crystal. Look at Mark's paper. What do the pressure distributions look like? And fold it in. So this is.
I agree with you. I completely agree. I mean, you can use this down to a few nanometer, and then you what?
You don't have to do the full calculation atomistically.
I agree. That's what I'm trying to say in this whole presentation. Do you apply? Yeah, okay, good. Let's proceed. Because I really haven't come to what I want to speak about. Now, when I came here, I spoke with Baumberger. They had done some new interesting experiment, which they claim show that the shear stress when you slide a small plexiglass lens on a flat, very flat surface, it depends very sensitively on the perpendicular stress in the contact area between this plexiglass lens and the substrate. For me, this was completely very strange because I don't believe there is any pressure dependence in the shear stress at those low shear stresses. This was seen even at 10 megapascal normal stress. And at that point, there should be no dependence on the, in my opinion, of the frictional shear stress on the normal stress. So, what they did is that they took, they melted a small droplet of a small piece of plexiglass, and they put it on a substrate and cooled it below the glass transition temperature. Then they get a very smooth hemispherical lens, and then they used that to do these friction studies. And they thought that this lens is basically molecular smooth, or at least they assumed that it is molecular smooth. However, it is not molecular smooth. And the reason for that is that all liquids have thermally excited capillary waves on the surface. And of course, these capillary waves are very small, but as I'm going to show you, they still make a huge difference. So I've indicated here thermal excited capillary waves on a liquid. It could be melted plexiglass. And the most simple theory, I mean, I'm sure most of you know about this, but just to refresh it, the energy of such a surface, you can write as an integral over the area. Here's the surface tension, and here is the gradient of the displacement, normal displacement here. And you expand this in this term here, and you get this term here. And in Fourier space, you get this contribution here. And then each of these normal modes here is like a harmonic oscillator. They must carry the kinetic energy, kbt, or half a kbt. So you know that this is true. And then you obtain the power spectra, because the power spectra is nothing but the square of the Fourier transform of this height fluctuation. The power spectra is given by kbt divided by surface tension times q squared. This is a very standard result you find in almost any textbook on physics or surface physics. In actual fact, it's slightly more complicated. And it's given by this. The actual value for the power spectra is given by this function here. It has also a gravitational term in it. If you look at the system at low magnification, at long wavelengths, gravitational effects becomes important and will flatten the surface. So you have this term here. And then there turns out to be something they call bending stiffness associated with the surface. This is usually rather small, but for polymers, which interests me here, it is not that small. So you need to take into account this stiffness term too. So now you have this droplet, and you cool it below the glass transition temperature. What happens is that the capillary waves, they slow down when you reach the glass transition temperature, and they basically get frozen in at the glass transition temperature. So the temperature you have to put in here, if you look at the surface at room temperature, you have to put in not the room temperature, but you have to put in the glass transition temperature, which for plexiglass is about 100 degrees Celsius higher than the room temperature.
Well, are gamma and kappa have a significant temperature dependence? No.
Probably they have, but the values which enter here again should be the one
right.
at the glass transition temperature.
Right.
And actually, I'm relying most on experimental data now. I'm not relying so much on. Okay.
The reason I ask is that if they do have a significant temperature dependence, then the rate at which you cool and get to the glass transition temperature will change.
But this usually changes very, very little because the glass transition temperature changes very, very little with the cooling rate. You can maybe shift it by 10 degrees Celsius, not more, depending on how fast you cool it. So I think this is that effect is completely negligible with respect to all other numerical problem I have. So actually, this has been measured experimentally. People have done used atomic force microscope on polymers, which they have cooled down below the glass transition temperature. And you see exactly what you see in here. It is plotted here. You have, if you plot log of power spectra, function of log of wave vector, you have the flattened out region coming from the gravitation. So this is a roll off now. It has nothing to do with any particles like in the asphalt, but it's just coming from gravitation, flattening the surface. Then you have the 1 over Q square region and 1 over the Q4 region. This has been measured by atomic force microscope. Unfortunately, not for plexiglass, but for many other polymers, which has the same similar glass transition temperature and similar molar mass as for plexiglass. So I'm using this expression for the power spectra in what follows. And I use the glass transition temperature, which is known. I use the surface tension, which is known. And I use a kappa, which I've taken from measurement from this other on other polymers. But it doesn't change very much. When you go from one polymer to another polymer, this kappa, which determine this, or you switch from this region to this region, correspond always to a wave vector of order 10 to the 8 meter minus 1. So this bending stiffness becomes important when you reach wavelengths of a few hundred angstrom. Not above that.
Just so where would the inverse radius of curvature fit in that graph? If you take 1 over RC.
Excuse me?
Where would the radius of curvature of the plexiglass and
The radius, this droplet was a few millimeter in diameter. So it's sort of microscopic. So this has, the droplet is, the radius would correspond to out here somewhere.
Okay.
The radius is so large, so small, that in the contact area is so small that you can actually neglect this flattened out reading. Gravitational effects are not important for this experiment. So now I'm coming to closer to there. So we have this droplet now with a, where we know we have actually some roughness coming from capillary waves. And with the experiments they did is they took this plexiglass lens and they slided it on a very, very smooth surface. And they thought they had perfect contact here. So when they analyzed the data, they assumed there's perfect contact within this region here. They looked at this system using an microscope, optical microscope, and they could see the radius here. You see like a black circle. And they thought within this black circle, you have perfect contact. Now I claim you don't have perfect contact. Because of this roughness coming from capillary waves, the contact actually looks like this. And at the lowest pressure they used, I claim you have only 10% contact inside here, not 100% like they assume, but only 10% contact. If you have much smaller contact inside here, then of course the shear stress, which you need to have in the area of real contact, will be much larger. If you have only 10% contact, you need 90%, you need 10 times larger shear stress here in order to get the same friction force. So I analyzed the data using this my contact mechanics theory, and here I show you the result. They looked at nominal squeezing pressures, which is in the range between 0 and up to almost 100 megapascal. And here I have applied my theory using basically only known parameters, calculated the area of real contact divided by the nominal contact area. I obtained this solid line here. This is what my theory predicts for the contact area function of the load. Before, I only told you about this linear regime here, about the slope of the initial linear regime. And you can see the slope is valid out to maybe one-tenth of the full contact. The blue and the green data points the data value from the work of Baumberger and Caroli and this other guy, which I don't remember the name, who actually did the experiment. I'm sorry for that. So when I plot this data here, I have actually plotted the shear stress they measured, they thought they measured, divided by the actual shear stress, or the shear stress when you have full contact. So that ratio here is the same as the ratio between the areas, the area of real contact and the nominal contact area, because you just make use of this equation here, that the friction force you can see either as being the nominal stress times the nominal contact area or the actual stress times the true contact area. And so you get this equation here. So the data I have just replotted in this way here, and you can see I can beautifully explain the data by just assuming that what actually happened is that the area of real contact is different from what they thought. It's in general much smaller. The first data point here, you can see it's only 10% contact instead of 100% like they assumed.
So, well, this is your theory with no adhesion,
yeah,
which is consistent with the fact that the pull-off forces they measure are very small on these surfaces.
I can put in, I have not had time for that. I can also put in adhesion. I have another variant of this theory, which also include adhesion, and I'm going to do the calculation when I get time. So this is without adhesion, assuming that adhesion is not important.
And this is still the calculation where you assume a flat surface, or do you have the effect of the tip curvature?
Yeah, this is still with assuming a flat. I can also apply it to curved surface. I've not done that, but it will not be. This pressure is a nominal pressure. This is the load divided by this nominal contact area. In reality, the pressure is varying within the contact, like in a Hertzian contact. One can easily take that into account. I haven't done that in this curve either. It will not make it. I know from earlier that it will not make any big difference to this curve. Okay. Now I want to tell you about the second topic I've been working on. Actually, how much time do I have left? Do I have 10 minutes?
Sure, yeah. At least.
Okay.
The way the rest of us have been going, you have a lot more than that.
Okay, good. Okay, good. So I've been working for several years now on rubber friction, which started up everything else I've been doing, basically. And the reason was that 4 years ago, Pirelli, tire company, Italian tire company, contacted me and wanted that I help them to understand the friction between a tire and the road surface. And I developed a computer code, or a theory for this, and a computer code, which is actually used today by Goodyear and by Continental, maybe somebody else, I don't know, in producing better rubber compound for tires. This is not what I'm going to tell you about, because that is rubber friction on rough surfaces. I'm going to tell you about rubber friction on smooth surfaces, which is also extremely important in practical application. For example, in ceilings and wiper blades, rubber friction on smooth surfaces is extremely important. And just to review this topic, on rough surfaces, the rubber friction comes about when you slide, you have asperities here, which give rise to time-dependent deformation of the rubber in some volume elements here. So you dissipate energy inside the rubber, and that is basically the origin of rubber friction on rough surfaces. Now the complication here is that you have roughness on all length scale, and you have to take into account those deformations on all length scale, and you have to take into account temperature effects, flash temperature effects, and things like that.
You're talking about smooth rubber surfaces on the rough,
yeah.
Sliding on the rough.
Yeah, surface. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's not what I'm going to talk about. I just want to give that background. This is how it looks like for rough surfaces. Now I'm going to speak about smooth surfaces, the rest of my talk. This was just the introduction.
I like that it's very comfortable.
Yeah. So now I'm coming to smooth surfaces. The substrate is smooth, not rough anymore. And the rubber is also smooth. And this is an old topic, going back to Schalamach. His picture of the friction is the following, that you get, because of adhesional interaction, you bind some patch of the rubber to the surface, many patches. I indicate just one of them here. When you slide, you need to reach some local shear stress down here, or local stress down here, in order to break this junction. So first you elastically deform it, and then it breaks, and it moves quickly, and you dissipate all the elastic energy which was stored up here. Or on a more molecular level, maybe you can see about it some chain, rubber chain, which adhere here, it gets elastically deformed, it flips off, and you dissipate all the energy. This will give friction on a microscopic scale. I have also suggested, but I'm not going to talk about that, that most real surfaces, even if they're very smooth, they have still some roughness, and the rubber can adhere to that, and when you slide, you will get bulk deformations again, just like in the top picture here. But now the deformation comes from the adhesional interaction rather than the applied load. So
in your first picture here for the rough surface.
Yeah.
I mean, this gives rise to energy dissipation, but I don't see how it gives rise to traction.
Energy dissipation due to lateral forward motion is friction, and friction gives rise to traction. Okay, now I'm coming to rubber friction on smooth surfaces. And the first measurement on this, or maybe Tarbo and company also did some measurement, but the experiment which everybody today referred to is the experiment of Grosch, who did a lot of experiments around 1960 or something like that. So it's again a rather old topic. And on smooth surfaces, you have a smooth glass surface, for example, you find something which looks like a Gaussian. Here's the friction coefficient or the shear stress, frictional shear stress, whatever you want. You find a curve which looks like a Gaussian, typically, depending on the rubber, centered around 1 millimeter per second in sliding velocity, and extending over many the full width and half maximum is many decades in velocity. If you take another rubber compound, and there's hundreds of different types of rubbers, then in general it looks the same, but the curve gets shifted to somewhat else, and it depends a little on the glass transition temperature of the rubber. And the kind of experiment these people did is illustrated here. The experiment by Grosch, he had a rubber block, and he fixed the upper surface, I think, to some hard glued it on something, and he had actually not a smooth surface, he had a wavy glass, so the glass was very, very smooth, except for this long, very long wavelength roughness. So it was microscopic wavelength roughness of maybe a few millimeters, but there was no other roughness. All these asperities were smooth, maybe not perfectly smooth, because we know about these capillary waves. But these capillary waves doesn't matter with respect to rubber friction. They matter with respect to the problem I told you about before, but not with respect to rubber friction, because rubber is elastically much softer than plexiglass. It's 1,000 times softer. You will make perfect contact in this region here, even if you would have some capillary waves. And the other experiment people are doing is that they take a lens of rubber and they slide it in kind of Hertzian contact on a flat surface. Or they take a hard ball, glass ball, say, and slide it on a rubber surface. There's different variants. They all give the same result, basically.
Well, can I ask a question? When people do peel testing, do they see something similar in mode 1 fracture as opposed to mode 2 fracture of lifting rubbers off?
But in peel, you are probing the adhesional interaction, I think, rather than the frictional behavior, no?
Peel tests are not cyclic, meaning you, with friction, you're continuously making a break.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what I'm.
You're only breaking. Yeah. So unless you specify the previous history, you can't really make a difference.
But don't you get something similar when you peel out scotch tape, qualitatively?
But physically, it's probably not the same thing happening. I'm coming now to my theory on this, which is actually related to earlier theories, but I think I do things a little better than people have done before. Just before coming to that, let me mention one more experimental fact. This curve here obeys the double rho LF transform. And the double rho LF transform is something which has to do with the viscoelastic properties of the bulk rubber. It's nothing to do with the surface. The double rho LF transform relates temperature to frequency in the bulk. And the fact that this curve here obeys the double rho LF transform, which means that if you change the temperature, this curve just gets rigidly shifted. The fact that that is the case means that a very large influence on rubber friction is the bulk of the rubber. It's not just something at the surface. It involves, in a fundamental way, involves the bulk. Otherwise, you could never explain why these data always obey the double rho LF transform. So you need to invoke bulk rubber in a fundamental way, just like in sliding on a rough surface. So this is a picture I have. The picture which Schleiermacher had was basically that you detach a piece of rubber, a small patch of rubber, during sliding, and then it stays detached, sort of, not interacting with the surface, and then it attaches again. This process, I don't believe. It cannot detach, because the energy to detach it is much larger than the energy in general that you need to slide it. It's much the lateral barrier for sliding is much smaller than the energy barrier for detachment. This is a different story. This I didn't come to. If you have very soft rubber, in some cases you see Schleiermacher waves. So I have that in the picture. I didn't want to go into, because I'm not going to speak about it. If you have very soft rubber, you sometimes see detachment waves. There's no sliding at all here. You have only waves of detachment propagating from one side to the other side, and that makes all the motion. But this I didn't want to tell you about. So this is a special case. The kind of experiment I'm referring to are using more useful rubbers, which are harder, and then you don't see this mechanism, at least not on microscopic scale. You don't see any detachment waves. So my picture is the following, that at the interface, there are small areas. When you slide at very low velocities now, you have small areas with maybe a few nanometers region, which bind to the substrate, to the surface here, and this interface is pinned. And you need to reach a local shear stress at this region here, which is large enough to depin this region, and then it starts to slide. Still in contact with the substrate, but it starts to slide. Of course, it cannot slide very far, because it will start to hit into this region, which is over here, and which is still pinned. So it's the motion consists of such small patches in a sort of random way along the interface, moving in a kind of incoherent way. It's incoherent because this motion involves temperature. So there is a stochastic element. There is a energy barrier you have to go over in order for this to start to move. But you don't need to go over it by just the pulling motion itself. You can go over it by a thermal fluctuation. So it's a thermally assisted local slip event involving small patches on the nanometer scale. And one way of modeling this, it's very rough, I agree, but I think it captures basically everything which is important, is to use this kind of model, which I think the earthquake people are familiar with, but with some fundamental differences. So these springs here are not elastic springs. They are viscoelastic springs, and you can calculate them from the bulk viscoelastic modulus of rubber. And for those of you who think that rubber actually is an elastic material, I wanted to do this experiment. I forgot about that. But these are two balls. They look the same, but they have not the same properties. This is very elastic. This is basically overdamped. It stops immediately because the chemistry of this rubber is a little different from this. But if you would cool this, for example, or if you would heat it up, it would jump as much as this ball. So these things depend sensitively on temperature. But anyway, you can see that rubber is not elastic material. It's a strongly viscoelastic material. And these springs which you choose here, spring constants, are not spring constants. They are time-dependent integral operators which take into account the frequency dependence of the bulk viscoelastic modulus. And this you can basically work out exactly. And this is what I'm using in this theory. In addition to this equation of motion, you have the pinning force coming from this interaction with the substrate here, and you have a fluctuating force. And this is crucially important. This is a stochastic fluctuating force coming from the fact that when you have dissipation in these springs here, then we have the fluctuation dissipation theorem. You must also have a thermally fluctuating force coming from the temperature, and which is related to the manner part of the frequency dependence of this elastic modulus in the way I've indicated here. This one can all work out, and it turns out to be a little involved numerically, but it's rather straightforward. And you can look at the consequences of this theory. And now I show you the consequences. Excuse me? Yeah, this is in this term here. This is a pinning force during, before you start to slide. When it slides, this becomes a viscous force.
No, but the spring also said that the spring constants Kx were retarded in time or something like that.
Yeah, these are retarded. These are time-dependent integral. This has been derived directly from the elastic modulus. So it has not. This is a bulk thing. Actually, the viscous modulus of rubber, you can expand in this way here, basically exactly. And you can calculate the weights and the relaxation times. And real rubber has a huge distribution of relaxation times, extending over 10 decades in time, or maybe even more, because it's a glossy material that has a lot of different internal barriers to go over, and that corresponds to different relaxation times. This you can calculate. This you can obtain from the experimental method with scholastic modulus. This you know. You can fit this perfectly with this kind of expansion here. And then these elastic constants, which I told you about, in frequency space, they are just proportional to this viscoelastic modulus.
Those decades that you include in your time memory functionals for the damping.
What?
How many of those decades?
I include 10 decades. These are all which I need in this range of velocity which I'm looking at.
So included 10 decades?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah, and this sum goes over 10. You'd only need to put one relaxation time. When you fit, you usually need about one relaxation time for each decade. Okay. in frequency.
Right.
That's a standard way of
do
doing.
You end up getting a Hallowa.
Yes. 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 In yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now I come to what does this theory predict? And indeed, it predicts basically what you see experimentally. So here is with some comment which I have to do. So here are the calculation using Sturian Butadien rubber, working with this Thai company has forced me to learn all these stupid names of many different types of rubbers. But this is a standard rubber compound used in the tread blocks of tires, the most common rubber used in the tread blocks of tires. And so I apply this theory at 20 degrees Celsius. I obtain this curve here. A little noisy because when you come to low velocities, this is 10 to minus 5 meters per second here, very few blocks move at any given moment in time. And then you get a lot of statistical noise. You get this curve. If you do the calculation at 10 degrees Celsius instead, you can see that this stuff here shifts with one decade in velocity to the left. And this one decade in shift in velocity is just the shift coming from the LF transform. It corresponds to just one decade. When you change temperature with 10 degrees Celsius, you shift this shifting factor by one order of magnitude. So this comes just from the temperature shifting. If you look at the number of moving blocks at the interface, I show it here. This is a fraction of slipping blocks. So if all blocks slip, you have one. When you look in this region below 10 to minus 3 meters per second, this is a sort of thermal activated region, you can see here the number of slipping blocks. At 20 degrees Celsius, you have maybe 5% of the blocks slipping at any given time. If you go to 10 degrees Celsius, you have much less blocks slipping at any moment, maybe 10 times less blocks slipping at... No, excuse me, not 5%, because I multiply with a factor of 100 here. It's only 10 to the minus, say it's 0.1 here, 10 to the minus 3 fraction of the blocks are slipping here when you have the 20 degrees Celsius. And 10 to minus 4 is a fraction of blocks slipping when you have the lower temperature. Then when you come to higher sliding velocity, the number of blocks which are slipping start to increase very rapidly because when you increase the velocity, of course, it goes much quicker to increase the shear stress at the interface to the point where the blocks start to slip. And then it increases like this, and it goes up to unity, basically, when you come down here to this minimum here. And this very rapid increase here, this has to do with the viscous. I put in a viscous effect at the interface when the block is slipping. So this is basically, on a log scale, you get an exponential curve, which basically, you know, background contribution like this, coming from this viscous effect. So this agrees basically what you see experimentally, except for one thing, one important thing. When you do the experiment, not when you change the temperature, this side also switch. So everything moves. In this calculation, there's no shift on this side because of change in the temperature. This occurs only on that side. And the reason for that is important, and I'm going to tell you about that, because it has to do with how this experiment was done. This experiment was done in this way. Let me first say that if I would apply the way they construct these curves here is not by changing the velocity from 10 to minus 6 meters per second to, say, 1 meter per second. This is it's very hard to do. And in addition, when you come to high velocities, you start to get strong increase in the temperature at the interface, and you don't want to have that. So the way they do it is that they only look at very low velocities, maybe this range here, and then they change the temperature, and then you get a lot of segments which you can shift using the WLF transform, and you can shift all those segments to get this curve here. So the actual measurement here was always done at very low velocities, below 1 millimeter per second, and then you put together this curve by doing the measurement at different temperatures using this WLF transform.
Why didn't they plot the data the way they measured it against temperature?
They have also this. You mean you want to have those pieces? They also have those pieces if you want to look at them.
I know that that's what they did, but that's cheating.
You can get a figure where you have only the measured velocity interval and you have all those segments at measured at different temperatures.
That's not what they measured. They measured it against temperature.
They measure it in two Descartes in velocity and many different temperatures starting at minus 30 degrees Celsius.
So this is just a figment of their imagination.
If you don't believe in the WLF transform, then it is just... then it's even incorrect, yes. Yes. But you see, the fact that the pieces fits together.
Do you believe in your numerics?
I believe in my numerics, roughly at least. Let me now explain. If I would do the same, I want to only come to that. If I would do the same, then my curve would not go down here. It would continue just basically flat out here the whole way. And it would not go down like you see in experiments. So why does it go down in experiments then? And so I hope I don't make it too complicated for you. The reason it goes down in the experiment is that the contact area is changing. If you do this experiment here, when you start to slide at higher velocity or you make the temperature lower, the rubber gets colder, it becomes elastically harder, and the contact area decreases. And that will happen at... that corresponds to higher velocities. Higher velocities is lower temperatures. So this contact area decreases. If the contact area decreases, instead of having this continuing like a constant here, it will drop. And the same is true in this configuration. If you make the temperature lower, the rubber gets stiffer, the contact area is decreasing. And so this curve here was measured in this way. And I explained this drop coming from the change in the microscopic contact area, giving the drop down. That's the only way I can explain.
High velocities corresponds to?
Lower temperature.
Lower temperature.
Actual heating due to the sliding goes up, but you're talking about just there's less time to relax.
Heating effects is not important here because the measurement is only done at very low velocities, exactly in order to avoid heating effects. And in my theory, I also does not include heating effect in the simplest theory, which of course means that, something I want to plan to work on later. It means that the heating effect I expect to be important up in this region already. So this region has to be modified also by heating. And I know how it will modify things. When rubber gets warmer, it becomes more elastic, less viscous, so it will reduce the friction even more than is shown here. But this I'm not taking into account in this calculation. Good. This is basically what I wanted.
It was again the constitutive law that you had between the blocks and the surface.
This I have used different things. So in the simplest.
You just talked about the last two.
Yeah, I know.
It should be embedded.
Yes, I'm using different laws because I want to check how sensitive it is to the law. The simplest thing I used was just either it is pinned up to some critical stress. And then during sliding, I've just a Newtonian, a friction force, shear stress, which is proportional to sliding velocity, during sliding. That was my first case was like this at the interface, I have so that this is a shear stress. Here is the velocity. Have this static shear stress, you might call it critical shear stress. At that point, it starts to move, and when it's moving on this line here. And what happens is that it starts to move on this line, and then it relaxes down to zero and gets pinned again. When it comes to zero velocity, I assume it get back to the pin state. I've also done another calculation. The one curve I show you now was for another. Excuse me?
Does it ever come down to zero?
Yeah, because when you start at low velocity.
Into the minus T over some damping?
No, yeah, it depends on how big you choose the damping. But when you pull at low velocity, it will react back. It comes down to zero and get restuck. The other calculation I did now, I have assumed that, and that comes out of computer simulation, because I assume that actually between the rubber and the solid substrate is a very thin contamination film. It will always be in particle application. And this, so it's like it's thin adsorbate layer at the interface. And this can undergo kind of dynamical phase transition. There's a pinned state when you are on this axis here, and then there is a fluidized or moving state when you are moving here. But in general, there is a lower shear stress here where this fluid state becomes unstable, and it would like to go back to the pin state again. So in the second simulation, I assume that when it reaches this lower critical shear stress, it goes back to the pin state, but in a stochastic manner. So I use a random number to decide exactly when it goes back, because it's like an undercooled liquid, and the nucleation process or the pin state is sort of a thermally random process, thermally activated random process. But both those prescriptions give qualitatively the same curve. There is some numerical changes in the height of it, but otherwise there is no. The main thing of this is dominated by the bulk of the rubber and not the particular law you put in at the interface.
Can I ask a question about these discrete blocks? I mean, is this an attempt to do a continuum calculation?
Yes. Sort of, yeah.
Because, I mean, one of the things that the geophysicists have learned in doing these kinds of models is that.
But you see, it's not.
Sometimes the discreteness of it is kind of following up your actual solution.
No, let me add to this. It is not in a continuum limit. It is not in continuum escape in the sense that I want to make the block arbitrarily small. The block size are determined by this region where you have this pinning.
Which is related somehow to the roughness?
No, these are flat surfaces. I think it has to do with, if you would slide at a uniform velocity, the whole interface, this thin contamination layer, is in this fluidized state, say, liquid-like state. When you come to low enough sliding velocity, this becomes unstable, and it would like to go back to the pin state. And that will occur by nucleation of the pin state. And it will nucleate at many, many different points at the interface, and those will grow, and you will get like domains. And when they hit into each other, it stops, sort of. And that determines the size. It depends on the rate of nucleation and how fast these things propagate. We have seen such things in our computer simulations, so these things happen. You see it often domains formed when you have molecules and you slide and you come back to the stop state. You have many domains at the interface. And since this pinning occurs different times, there will be an inhomogeneous shear stress at the interface, because if something pinned earlier, say this one here, it means that since things are still moving a little, because the other region has not gone back to the pinned state yet, this will be elastically deformed before it has frozen at other places, sort of. This is a kind of qualitative picture I have. You end up with an inhomogeneous stress state at the interface.
What is it that controls the dimensions of these domains?
In this picture, the size of this pinned region would be related to how the nucleation, how quick the how often you nucleate and how quick this nucleation front propagates.
So they are sort of the result of a continuum behavior that somehow or other, due to the properties of the material, are resulting in these discrete sized regions.
It is like when you have a crystal. If you cool it down very quickly, you end up with a lot of small domains. each of them are sort of crystalline, and something similar happened here at the interface. You're in this fluidized state during sliding. When you come below some critical velocity, this becomes unstable. It likes to nucleate this pinned region, and you do it in many places at the same time, almost the same time, and they grow and they hit into each other, and this will determine some size.
So the size is not similar to the Larkin length, the way you describe it?
No, I don't think it. No, that's not the picture I have at least.
Shalamak actually applied the theory to his so-called Shalamak waves to calculate the wavelength and height, and got good agreement on this.
But look. I didn't speak about the Shalamak wave. This is a Shalamak.
I thought your domains are the same as the Shalamak.
No.
No.
Oh, okay.
This is detached radium propagate.
Shalamak waves, because you found it experimentally.
Okay. The only thing I think there is no good theory for how these instabilities exactly are set up. But what people know is that during sliding, you can, to good approximation, calculate the friction force which results from these Shalamak waves by just taking into account that here you have an opening crack, here you have a closing crack. And in the opening crack, you dissipate a lot of energy because this is a viscoelastic material. Just using this bulk viscoelastic dissipation at the crack edge can very nicely explain the friction force which is observed here. This was first shown by Fuller and Thomas, I think his name is, which are old rubber experts, pioneers in rubber friction, rubber adhesion.
Is the instability and Shalamak wave the same things or they are different?
This topic I did not speak about. This is completely different. Here there is no motion here. Here it's no motion at the interface between the surfaces. All the forward motion occurs by the propagation of such Shalamak waves. What I spoke about is where the interface here slides. Okay, not all regions are sliding at the same time, but during sliding there is no separation between the rubber and the substrate. And
what is the elastic instability?
It's a kind of buckling instability. If you apply a big force here, it tries to sort of bend over here, and when it bends over here, it leaves some region here where it is still not in contact. I mean, there is no good theory for this, but something like that. Experimentally, it always happens at the edge. I don't know if it's the front or the back. I always forget this. It happens at the edge of the contact. So it involves the shape of the object also. It is not just something at the interface. It nucleates here or there. I've forgotten which place.
So, well, can you tell us how your answer to the friction depends upon the size of the regions that move independently? And I also wanted to know a related question, which is, I gather you're using the bulk, Q equals zero, elastic module.
Yes. Yep.
And is there any information about how, as you go to finite Q small n scales, that moves?
No, this I'm not aware of. I'm using the bulk viscoelastic modulus, yes. My only comment there is that since this experimental data beautifully obey the WLF transform, which is measured of a big rubber block, which I just, exert oscillating forces to, it looks to me that unless at finite Q, at large Q, maybe it is the same, cannot be excluded, you have the same WLF transform, but it's not obvious to me. The fact that this is obeyed here very well indicate that it has to do with that using this long wavelength viscoelastic modulus is maybe not a bad approximation. But this I don't know. I don't know measurements of the Q dependence of the viscoelastic modulus of rubber. I don't know about any such measurements.
I think that there is some evidence that if you go down to the micron, 10 micron scale, that it's the same as the macroscopic scale, which is actually something Patty has done using on some tapes.
Yeah.
But I don't know if your length scale got much less than a micron, you might have been Yeah. Change by the time you go down to the mesh size or something.
No, no, I.
The
I,
block size is always sort of micron scale.
No, my in this calculation now I think I'm using 5 nanometer or something like that. I have forgotten exactly.
That's comparable to the physical discipline entanglement.
Yeah, I know that. I agree with you that the properties of a surface in a very thin layer is basically different from the bulk. And maybe the dimension I'm using is too small, but again, I would say that the fact that you observe the bulk WLF transform giving the correct temperature velocity dependence indicate that this modified surface layer in itself is not dominating the problem, because if they would have a different glass transition temperature or something like that, you should never observe the bulk WLF transform. You should get some surface modified one, and that you don't see. It's the bulk one which is.
So if you have elements that are on the order of nanometer, do you have relaxation times that are also of comparable timescales, nanoseconds?
There's a whole. I don't know what you mean by relaxation time.
He's using relaxation times, the same spectrum of relaxation times as for the bulk.
Yes.
But there's a certain. Okay. So
you have a lot of frequencies when you slide here.
Right.
Many frequencies. When you slide here, these undergo local stick slip motion. And the associated with that is a frequency, of course.
But you have an expression for E that had the tau.
This is. Basically, a Messier. This is a Messier quantity. Messier viscoelastic modulus. You mean this?
Right.
The experimental is Messier. The real and man are part of this over 10 decades in frequency. I use that data to just reformulate it like this, and you can determine these two parameters to perfectly reproduce the Messier viscoelastic modulus. And then I use this in my calculation because it's more convenient.
This frequency should be high enough if you have a
yes.
greater size.
Yes.
Context.
Yes, and it fits in.
Simply extrapolating.
He's assuming there's no dependence on wavelength.
No, but okay, good. But
Right, and that could be because at all length scales, you can have the polymer relaxing, and very slow relaxation processes could extend down to low frequencies, so that. Might work. I was asking partly because I'm curious, because I think it's an interesting question, if there's experimental data that says the spectrum of relaxation times has a scale dependence.
No, I don't know any experiment.
Interesting.
Right.
I don't know any experiments which has proved that.
There are experiments that show that even glass transition temperature is scale dependent when you go to very thin films.
Yeah, this I agree.
Although there's a huge fight in that literature over whether there's preparation, whether or not
right.
equilibrium mm-hmm. effects that impact that. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.